Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. In 1984, The Mystery of Life's Origin by biochemist Charles Thaxton, material scientist Walter Bradley, and geochemist Roger Olson caused an uproar and helped to launch what's called ID, the Intelligent Design Movement. Now in 2020, there's an updated edition with new chapters by more famous scientists, including James Tour and Stephen Meyer, one of the friends of RSR. So a chapter in the book on ID in the Origin of Life is about biological information, which is different from the kind of information we think of written in books. But let me paraphrase my old boss, Bill Gates. It's like much of the information in our computer programs, the information in living cells, only way more sophisticated. So when you do a copy and paste into an email or a Facebook post, or you copy a text and paste it into another text, that function, that copy and paste on your computer or phone, it's enabled by information. It's an instruction set, and instructions are information. And that function has the instructions to perform the requested task, to copy, and then to duplicate or paste the copy. That's the kind of information, functional information, that biological systems use, only far, far more complicated than that. So to talk through this ID chapter written by Stephen Meyer, we're honored to have a PhD in organic chemistry with us, with 3 decades in the pharmaceutical industry, most of that time at GlaxoSmithKline, Dr. Dan Reynolds. Dan, in almost 70 years since the DNA double helix was discovered, have materialists figured out how to generate functional information apart from intelligence?
The short answer is no.
That's the short answer. Dan, thanks for agreeing to come on the show and for picking the chapter in this book that we'll talk through, and that's Stephen Meyer's great chapter on information.
Happy to be here.
So let's launch right into it, Dan. Information tends to be the first problem that smacks the atheist right in the face.
Right. Trying to explain the genetic code, the sequence of amino acids and proteins or nucleotides and DNA and RNA, the sequences that give them function, that is probably the greatest mystery about life, about biochemistry. And people have been working on this, as you say, for decades, and still there's no real answer in sight if you're trying to explain it in materialistic terms, chemistry and physics only.
And you call it a mystery. That's the title of this incredible book, The Mystery of Life's Origin. But it really is a mystery to the materialist, to the person who believes that Jesus Christ is the creator of the universe. It is not a mystery. I mean, we don't know how the Lord programmed every living biological organism species, but we know that he's the origin of the information in a living cell.
I agree wholeheartedly from not only a scientific point of view, but certainly scripturally, that is what we know to be true. So, you know, no matter how you look at this, you're left at no conclusion except that an intelligence was involved in generating the information in these molecules.
Mm. And Dr. Dan Reynolds, by the way, I mentioned that you've been about 3 decades now in the pharmaceutical industry, the last few years serving as a consultant, but you've also been active in the field of creation science.
Yes, sir.
So I think you're in the Research Triangle Park area of North Carolina, and you're very involved in the local creation group there.
Oh, it's the Triangle Association for the Science of Creation, or TASC for short, T-A-S-C.
Super. Yeah.
And TASC has been around for almost four decades. It has had a dynamic number of scientists come and go, but it's been around for a long time in the Triangle area.
Super. So as you and I talk through Steve Meyer's chapter, one point that I might try to make is that I think occasionally our side, the side that sees that you need an intelligent designer, tends to give even more credit than is due to the folks trying to explain a biogenesis, where I think they've made actually zero progress in the effort to explain the origin of information. They do a little bit of chemistry and a little bit of building blocks work, but nothing on the origin of the information in the DNA or RNA molecule. So could we talk about, with your background in organic chemistry, and you earned your PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, so I think I'm asking the right person, could you explain some of the biochemistry basics that we could use for the rest of our discussion?
Sure. So, you know, what we're talking about in a cell, any cell that we know of on the earth, from the simplest to the most complex, is that they all have DNA, RNA, and proteins. And they have a system that works like this. DNA is an information carrier. It consists of four different types of nucleotides. They're given the letters A, C, G, and T. And it's the arrangement, the sequence of those letters that convey meaning or function to the DNA molecule. So what happens is the DNA, when there's signaling in the cell that indicates it's time for protein production, the DNA is unwound. One of the strands, we know DNA is a double helix. Crick proved this structure in the 50s.
Yes, it's like a spiral staircase, and the steps of the staircase carry the information. We call them the nucleotides.
Yes, sir. And so something, an enzyme called RNA polymerase, attaches itself to the DNA, and the DNA is unwound. The RNA polymerase copies one of the strands from a designated starting position to a stopping position, and it generates something called messenger RNA.
Okay, now, so, Dan, being a radio talk show host, I'm used to trying to help the audience visualize what the scientist I'm talking to is describing. So if you could imagine a spiral staircase with how many nucleotides in the human genome? Do you have an approximate estimate?
Yes, there's about 3 billion.
Okay. So about 3 billion steps on a spiral staircase, and a section of it that has to be copied. Sometimes the whole thing does when the cell divides, but a section has to be copied to make a protein, say.
Yes.
And so there's a little machine, a molecular machine, that rides along the spiral staircase and makes a copy of all the steps, all the nucleotides in order. So it's making a copy of that portion of the DNA molecule.
Right.
Wow.
And so then that copy, which is now RNA, and it's a single strand of RNA, it's not a double helix, that single strand of RNA may be edited further by other enzymes. And then the final transcript, the final RNA, messenger RNA transcript, is transported out to a organelle, a molecular machine called a ribosome.
Right.
And so then in the ribosome, the RNA is translated. The information in the RNA molecule is translated into a sequence of amino acids. And that sequence of amino acids makes a protein. And that protein will have some specific function based on the sequence of amino acids. The protein will be folded up into a three-dimensional shape by other molecular machines. And then once it's in the correct shape for its function, it's transported to the place in the cell that it's required to help the cell's metabolism or something structural or whatever.
And everything that you've just described, all those functions, they're all accomplished by proteins or very complex proteins called enzymes. And the information for those proteins is on the DNA molecule. And so it's a severe chicken and egg problem.
Absolutely. And so one of Michael Behe's concepts, irreducible complexity, comes to mind because the simplest life form we're aware of has this DNA being transcribed to RNA, being translated into protein scenario. Mm-hmm. And so the DNA is the information carrier that has the needed information to build the proteins, but the proteins are necessary to transcribe the DNA, to convert RNA into protein. And so, like you say, you have a chicken and egg question. If you take any part of that system away, if you take away DNA, RNA, or proteins, the whole system collapses and it doesn't work. And so the question would be, if you need all those parts for it to work, what could possibly have been an evolutionary precursor to that system, since you need all the parts for it to work? And this is Behe's irreducible complexity concept.
Yes.
Now, you know, a lot of people have speculated that there was some simpler self-replicating chemical system that eventually evolved into the present DNA, RNA, protein world.
So they dump the DNA and they call it RNA, the RNA world.
Yes.
And so if we could take a moment about that, I mean, RNA is not as stable as DNA, right? So in the early primordial soup, if DNA started to form randomly, chains of polymers, that's somewhat stable. You go to a crime scene 30 years later, you could get some DNA. RNA molecules, they are way less stable than DNA. That's one problem. They fall apart.
That's right.
Another is the molecules they would need to build up the prebiotic molecules, the majority of them, the different kinds, they dissolve in water. So that's a huge problem. And NASA's senior astrobiologist admitted that to us in a question proposed to her, Dr. Mary Wojtek, in Germany about a year ago. And she said, well, it is true, water, you have to dehydrate your specimen. Otherwise, your prebiotic chemistry is not going to work. And the moderator from the journal Science, one of the editors there, he said to Mary, he said, you mean water is a problem? Water is actually a problem? Everybody thought it was the solution. It's a major part of their problem.
Well, it's true for abiogenesis, because so many of the precursors are susceptible to hydrolysis, that as soon as you form them, it's a ticking time bomb before it falls apart, well before it could polymerize. And even if it could polymerize rapidly, there's no way for it to be sequenced correctly to be functional. So it's just randomly combining into polymers that have no function or biological meaning whatsoever. So it's just a very difficult thing. And as you say, even if, and we're being generous, even if they had all four nucleotides that make RNA,
right,
it's still the polymerization problem. Just getting it to polymerize is difficult. And then to get it polymerized in the right order to have any biochemical significance is also an enormous problem.
After
it's a
decades,
very difficult problem.
We're speaking with Dr. Dan Reynolds, longtime active member of the Triangle Association for the Science of Creation in North Carolina. And Dan, you've been the president of that group also, haven't you?
Yes, I'm currently the chairman, but many of us have served as chairman.
Sure.
It's my turn, I think.
Well, thank you so much for doing all that. So this RNA world, I think the latest is that brilliant biochemists have figured out how to generate two of the four nucleotides in RNA. So that's how far they've gotten. And they've sold this to the public because they've said, unlike with DNA, when you need to self-replicate and then you need all these protein tools, an RNA molecule by itself could self-replicate. And they've really oversold that claim to the public, because my understanding is that they've gotten with incredible intelligence put into designing this stretch of RNA. They've been able to get it to self-replicate 10% of itself. But even if they were able to design an RNA strand that self-replicated 100% of itself, there has been tremendous intelligence poured into that effort over decades trying to figure out how to do it.
That's true. So people have tried to design self-replicating RNA systems, and they've had some success with that. A man by the name of Gerald Joyce, who's with the Scripps Institute out on the West Coast, in 2009, he came up with a self-sustained replicating RNA enzyme. But the thing is, it's deceptive in what you hear, because all it does is form one bond. It's not like it's taking all the monomer nucleotides and step-by-step replicating the original structure of the enzyme. So they start with an enzyme that they designed, and then they got it to where it will form one bond. And so you have a self-replicating system, but all of the information that it's based upon was designed by Joyce and his colleagues,
right,
as you say, over a very long period of time. All these people have PhDs in chemistry. It really does go to show that you could potentially have a self-replicating RNA system. It does show that. But it has nothing to say about how that system could have emerged by natural processes in the first place.
Right. What they're demonstrating is intelligence that has a very specific goal in mind, foresight, could work toward this functionality.
Right.
Right. But you don't get computer functionality just by random chance and natural selection.
That's right. To the extent that the RNA world folks have had any success, they're demonstrating that it took intelligent input in order to get that success. And they haven't really overcome any of the hurdles in the whole thing. You know, how do you make monomers naturally? How do you get them to polymerize? How do you get the sequence? And as we speak, there's still no known natural occurring or even artificially made self-replicating RNA molecule that no one has even figured out how to make one yet, let alone shown how it could occur through some sort of naturalistic scenario.
So really, when they go to RNA world, they've wanted to simplify the problem to show that it could happen materialistically, naturally.
That's
but
right.
They haven't really simplified the overarching problem, the complexity, because you have to be able to encode information and store that information, functional information, to build parts of your system. And there's an information, fundamentally, it's shared via symbols, symbolically, some kind of alphabet or hieroglyphs. Or in the case of DNA, every three rungs on the spiral staircase, every three nucleotides represent a single amino acid. We call that our 3-to-1 challenge that we went out to Oxford, and we couldn't see Richard Dawkins. We tried, but we left a beautiful printed copy, a glossy graphic of the 3-to-1 Dawkins evolution challenge in his faculty inbox at New College. And it asks, forgetting about all the complexity of the DNA system, can you, Dr. Dawkins, could you explain from Darwinism just the 3-to-1 correspondence where three nucleotides represent a single amino acid to be built into a protein? Could you just describe how that would arise naturalistically? And I don't believe they can. I don't even think they could think about the problem and how to solve it, because it involves symbolic logic and the laws of chemistry and physics. The classic laws, they don't have symbolic logic functions. They can't symbolize amino acids, is my
take.
Absolutely
right.
Wow.
You know, the origin of the genetic code, which Crick back in the 60s finally figured out, again, remains a total mystery. no one knows where this could have come from a naturalistic standpoint.
Mm.
Even if you had a DNA molecule with the right sequence in it and you had nothing else there,
right.
There's no chemical affinities between DNA and amino acids that would cause the amino acids to straddle the DNA molecule and align in the right sequence and then be bound together into a protein.
Wow.
So there's just no chemical explanation for that.
Yeah. So back in January, my co-host Fred Williams and I, we did a show on Shannon information. Steve Meyer discusses that in this chapter. And our show was titled Reducing the Uncertainty About Shannon Information, because sometimes creationists and evolutionists, they argue about it. I thought Steve Meyer did a brilliant job in explaining it in this chapter. Could you give us a brief overview of the role of Shannon information in thinking through these issues?
Well, so one of the things the intelligent design movement has wanted to do, and I think they've had some good success, is to bring the action of intelligence in the world into empirical science. And so to do that, you have to be able to measure what intelligence does, and intelligence generates information. So one of the questions is, how could you ever quantify or measure information in some biological system? And so it turns out this man by the name of Claude Shannon, who worked for the Bell Labs back in the 40s, not thinking about evolution or anything else, what he figured out was that the information content of some system that is a sequence of symbols, be it letters or numbers, or and it can be applied equally well to sequences of nucleotides and DNA or amino acids and proteins, he came to understand that information is tied to the probability of a arrangement of symbols. And he was able to formalize the relationship between information and probability. The information is equal to, and this is not real important for people to know, but just so that they can hear it, it has been understood.
Right.
It's the minus the logarithm base 2 of the probability of the formation of the sequence.
So that you could mathematically, you could calculate the information carrying capacity of some system.
That's right. And, so, exactly. So if you have a string of letters, let's say English language, let's say we have 26 letters, and let's also throw in spaces between words, for example. So we have 27 potential characters. So if you've got, you have a sentence, what is the probability of any letter in or space in that sentence actually occurring randomly? Well, it's 1 out of 27. And so you can see that each time you add a letter to the sequence, the probability is decreased by a factor of 1 over 27. And so for a sequence of letters that has N letters and spaces in it, the probability of that occurring by chance, that sequence of letters, that specific sequence of letters that has meaning in English, would be 1 over 27 to the nth power, or 1 over 27 times itself, N times. So you can quantify the amount of information that's present in a sentence. You can also do it with DNA. You can also do it with proteins, and come up with a number. And then what has been done by a man by the name of Bill Dembski, who's been in the intelligent design movement for a very long time. He's got a PhD in mathematics from Chicago University. Brilliant guy. And if people are interested in this area, I strongly recommend reading his work.
Sure. And he helped to figure out the probability of a single, 150 amino acid protein forming, the probability resources. And his argument was, if you took the entire universe as a big biochemical laboratory, and every single particle in the entire universe was going through millions of chemical reactions per second, how many potential proteins could you form just randomly in the age of the supposed age of the universe at 13 billion years?
That's right. So if you come up with the probability of forming a sequence of something like DNA, RNA, an English sentence, or whatever, and you want to ask the question, could that have occurred by chance? Well, the way you have to answer that is, what are the probabilistic resources available to you to produce that sequence? Sort of like going to Las Vegas and betting on the roll of a die. The question of whether you'll ever get a roll of the die that you want depends on how many rolls of the dice you get. Mm. If you only get one roll, the probability is really small. But if you get 100 rolls, then your chances of getting one outcome that you want is very high.
With two dice, right.
So you have to know the probabilistic resources available to answer the question of whether a sequence could occur by chance or not. So Chomsky, as you say, he calculated, well, what are the probabilistic resources available in the entire universe?
Because in order to get the single protein with 155 amino acids, which is a very modest sized protein, the chances of that is it's one chance in 10 to the 195th. So that number is just beyond comprehension. But go ahead. How did he determine the probability of that?
Well, as you were saying, so it's generally accepted that the universe contains 10 to the 80th power particles.
All right.
And so since if you assume the universe is 13.8 billion years old, that's represented by 10 to the 16th power seconds.
Okay.
And if you want to think of what is the fastest possible physical process that could ever exist, not that we know of one that's anywhere near this fast, but just what is the limit to what a physical process's rate could be, it would be dependent upon the Planck time. It's what they call the Planck time.
Yeah.
It's the smallest unit of time that could exist. So you could have up to 10 to the 43rd power events per second if you could get something to occur as fast as the Planck time. And so now you can take the number of particles that are in the entire universe times the age of the universe, times the number of events that could have ever occurred during that time with that many particles, and you get 10 to the 139th power. That's how many times you get to roll the dice, is 10 to the 139th power. And so now you've got a probability of forming one specific protein with 150 amino acids. The value is 10 to the 195th power. So it's obvious that the universe doesn't have the probabilistic resources to make it probable that you would generate a specific protein with a probability of forming of 10 to the 195th power, one chance out of 10 to the 195th power. So in other words, by chance alone, there's no chance that a modest protein, one modest protein, would ever form in the entire history of the universe. And Dembski, Meyer doesn't touch upon it, but in Dembski's work, he actually estimates what it would take to get to the age of the universe when it experiences heat death. And the universe, because of the second law of thermodynamics, is losing useful energy.
Right. It's wearing down.
It will run out of useful energy. And at that time, it's so-called heat death. What he comes up with then, it will be trillions of years old, not just billions. And he comes up with the probabilistic resources of the entire universe at heat death would be 10 to the 150th power.
So you would still need billions and billions of universes to get one protein.
Right.
By random chance, because there's no natural selection that could kick in before you have a self-replicating biological system. And then Dan Reynolds, let's say it did happen, right? Even though you need trillions and quadrillions and quintillions of universes to randomly get one average-sized protein, let's say it did happen and you got the protein. There it is.
Right.
Nothing is going to happen. The universe will not know that it just made a protein, and that protein is just going to decay. It's going to fall apart.
That's right. It won't be able to replicate itself. And so it'll just be a sequence that, because it's not in a biological context, it really won't matter that the sequence that you desired was formed, and it'll hydrolyze, light will destroy it, oxygen will destroy it, heat will destroy it, but it won't hang around. And, you know, to get the simplest life form, you need hundreds of proteins, you need hundreds of thousands of nucleotides in the right sequence in the DNA. You need ribosomes, you need all kinds of other molecular machines, you need a lipid bilayer with ports that let things in and out selectively. And then you'd have to have all those things at the same place, at the same time, and arranged in the right way.
You just brought this question to mind, Dan, when, as far as I know, the most they've accomplished using the most sophisticated laboratory techniques is an RNA molecule that could self-replicate 10% of itself, 10%. That RNA molecule, I'm not a biochemist, I haven't read the papers behind that work, but I don't know how long that molecule is, how many nucleotides in it, but I would think it's got to be around 150 or more.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't read
those I mean, it just can't, logically, it can't be 10 or 20 or 30. There's not Right, there's not enough length to give it any kind of a three-dimensional form that could make a machine to do these things.
So Joyce's
Joyce's
system that we spoke of earlier, where it is a self-replicating RNA enzyme system, has hundreds of nucleotides in it, and all it does is form one bond. It doesn't close to, you know, it doesn't replicate.
Okay, so
nucleotide by nucleotide.
So let's think about that. Right, that Joyce's work, what it did was it took two polymers and joined them together.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, look, we have self-replicating RNA, which was a tremendous exaggeration, which happens through the media to benefit the misinformation of the atheist. But that's hundreds of nucleotides. And this example where you need trillions and trillions of universes, that was for a protein of 150. So I would think the self-replicating RNA world molecule where it could self-replicate 10% of itself, I would think that's a couple hundred, a few hundred nucleotides long. And so for that to happen naturalistically, based on the probability resources of the universe, we're establishing that it would take quintillions of universes before those chemicals might, by random chance, come together.
Right. To any honest person, at least in my way of thinking, can't be the hero of the plot, because there's just no chance at all that any of these things would form that way.
Well, great point to conclude the show, Dan Reynolds, that chance cannot be the hero of the plot. Thank you so very much for joining us here on Real Science Radio.
Thank you, Bob, for the opportunity.
Well, you're very welcome. And we will link not only to the book, The Mystery of Life's Origin, but also to TASC, the Triangle Association for the Science of Creation. That was Dr. Dan Reynolds, PhD in organic chemistry. What an honor to have him on. And here at Real Science Radio, you know that this month is our telethon with our goal of $40,000. It's a very significant goal to help us continue to reach more people for the next year. So please, if you can, go to our website, rsr.org, and click on the store. You could subscribe or donate or get one of our science resources. So for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio, this is Bob Enyart. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.